I'm Tom Rowan. You're tuned into Turn on the News, 3.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. Tonight, the FCC fines broadcasters for not airing a telephone conversation they recorded. Well, not for not airing it, but they fined them for a recording that was never on the radio. Also, the TV networks are suing over people not watching their advertisements. And the United States Senate, there are some folks who want to reinstate domestic propaganda. We've got crazy news tonight. And we'll also look back from Lessons from Weimar Radio with Heather Contat from last weekend's TransX Transmission Art Symposium in Toronto, Canada. Stay tuned to Turn on the News from free103.9.org. Timer with Turn on the News. Tonight behind us is Daniel Blinkhorn's relatively loud tones from Terra Symphonica from the Deep Wireless 8 Radio Art Compilation. Deep Wireless is the monthly radio art festival in Toronto, Canada. And the final weekend of May would be the Radio Without Boundaries Conference. This year it was renamed the TransX Transmission Art Symposium. And 3103 was there, recording all sorts of events there. And we'll listen to Heather Contat's Lessons from Weimar Radio in a few minutes after the radio headlines first. And we go to Kim Andrew Elliott's reporting on international broadcasting blog at kimelly.nfshost.com. And he rounds up coverage of the effort to repeal the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 in the U.S., which disallowed domestic propaganda after World War II. There are a couple of senators, representatives and senators. This is in the House, actually, so it's not senators. In the House, representatives. And there's a statement from Communications Director for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand in BuzzFeed. She's a New York senator who's on the Senate Armed Forces Committee, where the bill is being considered. She says that as of last Thursday afternoon, the current does not include an amendment to, quote, strike the current ban on domestic dissemination. At the Columbia Journalism Review, let's round up. I'll get to that in a moment. Radio World also reports, Paul McLean writes there, as Radio World has reported the there are a couple senators supporting repeal of the 1948 ban on, quote, domestic dissemination, unquote, of content to listeners and viewers in the United States. The board believes the rule did not envision the internet or satellite broadcasting, which does not honor national boundaries. With all of its 59 languages available online, the agency cannot comply with this outdated statute. Right Side News, a right-wing, more right-oriented publication, says, quote, if the government propaganda experts decide that they don't like you, it's quite likely they could end up being a target of a massive misinformation campaign. It could come down to the fact that they simply don't like your blog or what you're saying on Facebook. They could decide it is best to destroy your reputation for the sake of, quote, national security. A Columbia Journalism Review, Emily T. Metzger weighs in. We, quote, we can't, as of now, really know whether the content of Voice of America is in fact truthful or propagandistic, routinely biased for or against the United States, whether the content champions are condemns American foreign policy. This content broadcast to audiences around the world can be exempted from American Freedom of Information requests, and American ethnic media outlets are prevented from rebroadcasting news that would serve their communities. With the ban, all we know for certain is that the content is financed by the U.S. government. This doesn't necessarily make it propaganda, but it certainly does make the content worthy of the same scrutiny savvy audiences apply to all media, unquote. Uh, over at HollywoodReporter.com, Matthew Bellany reports on that Fox, CBS, NBC are suing the Dish Network over AutoHop, an ad skipper product, and Dish has filed a countersuit against them because they don't want consumers to be able to skip advertisements. And a Fox statement, "We were given no choice but to file suit against one of our largest distributors, Dish Network, because of their surprising move to market a product with the clear goal of violating copyrights." Copyrights. It violates copyrights to not listen to or watch something? "And destroying the fundamental underpinnings of the broadcast television ecosystem. Their wrong-headed decision requires us to take swift action in order to aggressively defend the future of free over-the-air television." David Oxenford reports at his Broadcast Law blog that, with the headline, $2,000 fine for recording telephone conversation even though the conversation was never broadcast. Quote, "The FCC last week proposed to fine a broadcaster for calling someone with their tape recorder running with the intent to broadcast the taped conversation on the air. According to the notice of apparent liability issued by the FCC, the recording was stopped after the radio station announcers identified who they were and the person who was called said that he did not want to be recorded. What was taped was essentially the station employees calling the individual and saying hello, saying that they were from the radio station, telling the individual that he was being recorded, and the individual telling the employees to stop recording, which they immediately did. The recording was ended before anything substantive was said, and it was never broadcast on the air. Nevertheless, the station was fined $2,000 because the initial stages of the conversation were recorded with the intent to use the recording on the air. According to the commission, the FCC's rules require that when a conversation is either broadcast on the air or recorded for purposes of broadcast, the consent of the person being recorded must be obtained before the tape starts rolling. As with an over-the-air broadcast, if the tape is running when the person is being called by the station says hello, in the commission's view, the station has violated the rule even if the tape is never used." And of course, no one is using tape anymore, but when you press record on something like Audacity, and if you're the only one in the studio because you're a community radio station, it's often much, much easier to press record before you start messing with some other equipment that busies your hand so that you can no longer press the button to record. So this might be a budget issue, actually, that forcing small radio stations to have more than one engineer at a time. That was from David Oxenford's Broadcast Law blog. And now we're going to go to Toronto last weekend, where Heather Content gave us talk about lessons from Weimar Radio. The Weimar Republic occurred in Germany between 1919 and 1933. It was Germany's first democracy, known for its cultural developments and political volatility. A new series of revolutions in November 1918 and the abdication of imperial ruler Kaiser Wilhelm II led to its founding. The appointment of Adolf Hitler as German chancellor marked its ending. In addition to being the first German democracy, the Weimar Republic was also the first epoch to use radio as a public mass medium. So here is Heather Content, and we should introduce her first. She studies and produces radio. She does the podcast for N Plus One magazine and has taught at Pratt and the New School. She's currently seeking a PhD in programs where she can study the phenomenology of sound. And here is her talk from Toronto, Canada, from the TransX Transmission Art Symposium, Memorial Day weekend.
And hello, radio listeners that I cannot see. I'm very excited to address you. So I have some visuals, though. Use your imagination. Good luck. Okay. So when I started this project, I had no idea how pertinent it would be to the topics that we've discussed. So with that being said, the Weimar Republic is the period in Germany between 1919 and 1933. It was Germany's first democracy. It was known for its cultural development and political volatility. It was also the first period to use radio as a public medium. We'll just turn that down. Okay. So there were a lot of lessons that you can learn from studying Weimar radio. And here they are. Number one, there will always be boundaries. Number two, when you work in tension with these boundaries, you might create an aesthetic to shift the boundaries. Three, even though the boundaries are shifted, they are still boundaries. So, in the case of the Weimar Republic, there were two different types of boundaries. There were political boundaries and technical boundaries. The government of the Weimar Republic was particularly concerned that some extreme factions might use the radio as a way to incite a revolution. Perhaps the reason why they thought this is because on November 9th, 1918, that's the same day that Philipp Scheidemann stood on the Reichstag and declared democracy, 20 miles south of Berlin, there was also a radio revolution happening when a bunch of decommissioned military personnel who had all been trained to operate radios in the trenches, they took over the military-controlled radio station and made it a public radio station for the first time. This was called the Funkerspuk, or Radio Nightmare. So politicians were a little concerned. And so they put this guy, Hans Bredow. He's in the stamp right here. Oops. Go back. He's in the stamp right here. They put him in charge of the Reichsrundfunk Gesellschaft, which is basically the National German Radio Society. And he set some mandates. None of this was a legal thing that was discussed in the parliament or anything. It was all just a series of bureaucratic mandates that later became institutionalized in 1926 when they were just like, hey, by the way, these are the laws that we've made up. So of these things that Bredow had a major part in establishing, one, radio should placate the public, calm them from their troubles and their worries. Two, we should educate the public about high German culture. Three, non-political. Let's just not talk about politics at all. So, those were the general guidelines that established the political arm of Weimar Radio. There were also technical limitations, too. And this just comes from the fact that radio was in its infancy. The technology was in its infancy. From this picture, you can see some people listening to an early radio. They are all attached umbilically with headphones. That's because that was the only way to listen. External speakers didn't come till much later. It's funny that they're all wearing headphones because all these broadcasts are in mono. This cable coming down from the lamp is attached to the generator outside to power this machine, which uses vacuum tubes, making it able to receive air frequency radio waves. Most of Weimar Republic radio listening happened using just the ground waves, which do not travel very far. So actually the area of people able to listen to radio during the Weimar Republic was very small, and it was mostly an urban phenomenon. If you wanted to have a better set, you could listen to the airwaves and listen farther out, but that was expensive. So one interesting thing that happened during this time is this is when radio, 1923, when they actually established radio as a public medium, this is when they transformed radio from a two-way communications apparatus to a one-way broadcast-only directional system. Prior to that, it had always been two-way. During World War I, always two-way. The reason why they did this, they were afraid of all those people that knew how to hack receivers and turn them into transmitters. So they made it illegal to adjust your receiver, which you needed a license in order to own. This, ultimately, the technical and the political, led to an institution of Weimar Radio that was boring. It broadcasted in just one direction, and as Ernst Schön says, it broadcast culture with a capital C. Schön worked at the Frankfurt radio station, which hired Walter Benjamin to produce some children's shows. These were called Aufklärung für Kinder. There should be some umlauts in there, but Prezi doesn't like umlauts. So, he told radio stories. And they were pretty basic radio stories. They sounded much like anything else that you would hear on the air. They sounded like... This is called Zigeunerlied or Gypsy Song. Now, I take some liberties here with syllables. And if you know your avant-garde history, this is kind of like the Dadaist and Surrealist poetry, which is not culture with a capital C. It is culture with a lowercase c. You know, people's culture. Kind of like jazz. So what he did is he worked in tension with this institutionalized system. He was on the inside, though, right? He was totally allowed to do this. And by working in tension, he sort of shifted the institution. Here he is, pushing against those institutional walls. And I call these radio epiphanies. And the reason why is because they don't create harmony, they don't create dissonance, nor symphony or cacophony. Instead, they're epic. They're epic forms of radio or epic phony. For those listening to them, they might get an epiphany about the institution that they live in, the fact that it can be changed, that there are alternatives. And that's important. So, there were other epiphanies, too. They happened in two distinct ways, subversively or blatantly. So there were people on the inside, like Benjamin, pushing on the walls. This includes Hans Flesch, who Galen talked about yesterday. Thank you. So if Hans Bredow was the man of Weimar Radio, Hans Flesch was the dude. And he was a kind of created the idea of program director. And he did, in 1924, a play called Zauberei auf dem Sender, which is Sorcery of the Airwaves. And what it is, you know, everybody expected to tune in and hear a symphony for the night. But instead, they got a disaster. This is just the station calling out. Okay, and there's the interruption. So what happens is basically the storyteller comes in and she wants to tell a story. And it just proceeds like this, the transmitter goes out, it's a total disaster. Well, this was 1924, 15 years before Orson Welles did his thing, when people were also planning to hear a symphony and got something else instead. So, Flesch also commissioned, a few years later, Walter Ruttmann's Weekend, which I'm sure everyone knows. Maybe not. It's a sound collage that was constructed using sound film, a new technology. The whole time that this is happening, Flesch maintains that he wasn't trying to be political or do art. He was just testing out the technologies, okay? He was just, you know, trying to further the radio medium. This was not meant to disrupt, but it did. I mean, this is totally different. And although it's about 25 years early, it's like what Pierre Schaeffer did when he made sound art for the first time. So they say. people could produce epiphanies was by working outside of the radio institution. And for this, there were workers' radio collectives, and they did really cool things like we do, which is have conferences and listen to things in order to discuss how the world works, how radio works, how these institutions work. They built little tiny transmitters, stuff like that. They even also once kidnapped this guy that was supposed to appear on the radio and sent in their own guy instead, who went on the air and started talking about... who went on the air and started talking about anti-war stuff. So that's just a really funny story. And then there was also everybody's favorite, Bertolt Brecht, who did the Lehrstück. And this is what he talks about in Radio as Two-Way Communication Apparatus, that big essay that we all know. And basically it was the idea was this was a radio piece that you would communicate with. You would have lines and you would perform them with the radio. So here's some of this recently online. And if you listen to it long enough, you will hear it, and it doesn't sound so radical. In fact, it sounds like Brecht, you know? This is not too radical sounding to me. But there's a reason why. That's because after these boundaries were shifted, they still were boundaries. And Brecht was particularly affected by what Adorno calls the culture industry. The idea that culture becomes a commodity and people make money off of it. And this happened big time in Three Penny Opera, which is when they made Three Penny Opera merchandise like socks. Now, if you are a Benjamin fan, then you will know the alternative of the culture industry is the politicization of aesthetic. And that's when the culture industry becomes you. When culture becomes used as a device by a political power in order to propagate their own message. As Benjamin states it, they give people aesthetics so that they can express themselves, express themselves freely, but they don't give them any of the rights that might go with that aesthetic or might have developed that aesthetic in the first place. That, for him, is fascism and only has one effect, which is war. So, to exemplify this, we have Walter Ruttmann, who ended up working as assistant director for Leni Riefenstahl in Triumph of the Will in order to survive and keep practicing his art. He didn't get to express his own message, which was pretty leftist. Instead, he expressed propaganda of National Socialism. And also in Triumph of the Will, there's a scene in it where we see the Reichsarbeitsdienst perform what seems to be a Lehrstück, a call and response thing. Susan Sontag discusses that what happens here is the self-awareness of Brecht's Lehrstück, of the medium, the self-awareness of the medium gets taken away just in its pure portrayal. So, that's what happens. It's a big cycle. There are boundaries, there are epiphanies to shift those boundaries, but they are still boundaries. And it goes over and over and over. And you should be prepared for that, because that's how it works. And for this, I like to look at Badiou, Alain Badiou, who basically says in a theory of the subject, although I have no idea what that book's really about, I don't think anyone does, but what I gather from it is that you just have to keep trying. And you have to be prepared to push a boundary and have it become solid. And then push it again, or have other people push things too. So, that's it.
Thank you, Heather. That was wonderful. This is the time for question segment, and as always, if you can direct your questions to the microphone down on the floor.
Hi, could you tell us how pushing boundaries in your own work has worked or not worked? Give us any examples.
Well, I could talk about institutional boundaries. So I come from an institution that has some audio training, but not very much. It also has some audio equipment that usually doesn't work. Anyway, it's taught me to become a pretty rad producer with good problem-solving skills. Aesthetically is a little harder. For this, I like to sort of take something I've learned from, I want to say it's Jay Allison, who talks about, you know, sometimes you have to do work because it's paid, and it's not what you want to do. But you just have to do little things that are just little pieces of yourself, and putting little pieces of yourself in there. So, yeah. Also, I always try to do things as self-reflexively as I can. I don't know why that how that is a boundary. I guess some of the radio that I produce is for an institution that does not seem to look at itself very much, so I like to make it look at itself.
I'm Tom Burr. You're listening to Turn On the News. That was Heather Content from Brooklyn talking about lessons from Weimar Radio from the TransX Transmission Art Symposium in Toronto, Canada in the last week of May, broadcast on Free 103.9. You can hear the full recording with the full question and answer session at free103.9.org, where you can also find out more about transmission art and radio art, and you can also see newsroom.free103.9.org for more information about Turn On the News, a daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, and sound art, and more. Thanks for tuning in.